this 80-some-year-old woman who was so interested in life, who all my life had modeled for me a sense of curiosity and wonder about the world.
He always helped his mother in the garden.
Dear Mrs. Griffin, we don't like frightening little old ladies from the UP half to death.
We love stories!
It's time for the Appleseed, filled with stories for you and your family. All kinds of tales from all kinds of tellers. Tall tales, and folk tales, and fairy tales, and personal and family tales, and more. I'm Sam Payne, your host. It's such a pleasure to be with you. And today's a special day on the Appleseed. We're going to bring you an hour of tales celebrating Mother's Day. Mother's Day first became a U.S. holiday in 1914 due to the efforts of a woman named Anna Jarvis, who had lost her own mother just a few years earlier. And Anna Jarvis said that the holiday was made to honor the sacrifices of mothers for their children. Of course, humans have been celebrating mothers for much longer than that. The ancient Greeks and Romans celebrated Mothering Sunday, where they held entire festivals to honor the mother goddesses, Rhea and Cybele. And, of course, as years passed and centuries went on and celebrations merged between other parts of the world, Mothering Sunday came to fall on the fourth Sunday in Lent, when citizens would return to their mother church for a special service. And go even further forward, and, of course, Mother's Day turns into a day that we celebrate with giving gifts and cards and breakfast in bed to our moms in order to show them how much we love them. Now, we here at the Appleseed celebrate Mother's Day in the way that feels most meaningful and natural to us, through the telling of stories. So join us today for tales from Dolores Hydock, Linda Gorham, Doug Elliott, Pete Griffin, and Bill Harley, all for moms and the folks who love them. And up first, we're going to bring you a story from Dolores Hydock. This is a story called Occam's Razor, and it's all about her beloved mother and the special bond they share. Dolores Hydock hails from Pennsylvania, lives now in Alabama, is a wonderful storyteller, and this is a live recording before an audience of Occam's Razor. Dolores Hydock on the Appleseed.
There is a principle, a scientific and philosophic principle, called Occam's Razor. Any of you ever heard of Occam's Razor? O-C-C-A-M, Occam's Razor. It's named for William of Occam, a 14th century philosopher. And the principle is this, that if there is some phenomenon that you observe, something happens, and you see it, and you try to explain why it happened the way it happened, Occam's Razor says that the simplest explanation is probably the true one. For example, let's say you have a book on your desk and it's kind of hanging a little bit off the edge, and as you walk past, you bump the book and it falls, slam, crashing down to the floor. And you see that and you think, well, now why did that happen? Why did that book fall to the floor? Why didn't it just hang there in midair? Why didn't it float up to the ceiling? Why did it fall to the floor? And so you try to explain that phenomenon. Well, there's lots of ways to explain it. For instance, you might say that at just the very moment that that book was about to drop, a little band of angels magically appeared, hovering around it, holding it up, and staying with it until they saw it safely down to solid ground. And then the little band of angels disappeared again. Well, that would be one explanation. Or you could say that there is a force called gravity that exists in all objects with mass, and the gravity of the Earth is greater than the gravity of the book, and it was gravity that pulled the book down toward the Earth, and that's why the book fell. That is a simpler explanation, not requiring little bands of angels to appear and disappear at just the right moment. And being the simpler explanation, gravity is probably the true one. That is Occam's Razor. My friend David was explaining all this to me one evening several years ago as a way of telling me why I was wrong to be so angry about the clocks. "Look at this," I said to him. "Three clocks, three brand new clocks, expensive clocks, Waterford clocks, and not one of these three clocks works. Can you believe that?" "None of the clocks works," he said. "Not a one." That's when he explained to me about Occam's Razor. He said it would require far too complicated a series of coincidences for me to have walked into the store and purchased precisely the three clocks that didn't work. There must be a simpler explanation, he said, like some little plastic thingy that's keeping the batteries from making contact. He was right. On closer inspection, I discovered that there was, in fact, a little plastic thingy underneath each of those batteries, and once that was removed, the batteries made contact, and the clocks kept perfect time. The three clocks were gifts for the hospice nurse and two hospice aides who had taken such good care of my mother and me during the 8 months that she had been so sick. Those three women had spent countless hours answering questions, explaining procedures, patiently guiding us every step of the way. And now that their work with us was done, the clocks seemed like a small but appropriate way to try to thank them for the time that they had lavished on us. My mother had lived at my house during those 8 months that she'd been so sick. Years earlier, she had said to me, "I hope I don't ever have to go to assisted living." Actually, that's not quite what she said. What she actually said was, "I hope I don't ever have to go to assistant living." Assistant living, as if that kind of living wasn't full rank, top status living. It was just assistant living. It wasn't the first time she'd given a creative new interpretation to words. I remember one summer she and I went to see the two big Oscar-nominated movies of the year, the one about the two cowboys in Idaho and the one about the author of In Cold Blood. Somehow the titles of those movies merged together in her mind. I heard her on the telephone telling my sister that we'd gone to see Bareback Mountain and Coyote. Or the first time that she ever rode in my German-made automobile, she said, "I've never ridden in a VFW before." So no assistant living for her. "My saints are my assistants," she would say. And it was true. She had a whole roster of saints, each assigned to a particular task. Saint Anthony, for instance, is the go-to guy when you need help finding something that you've lost. St. Anne, patron saint of mothers. St. Jude, patron of hopeless cases. I said to her once, "Their duties seem to overlap a little bit. How do you decide which saint you go to with which problem?" "Well," she said, "most of the saints are specialists, but St. Jude is my primary care saint, so I go to him first." The subject of saints came up when I was up there in Pennsylvania helping her pack up her apartment as she prepared to move down to Birmingham. "Who's the patron saint of kitchen cabinets?" I said, "because boy, do we need help with these." "Saint Martha," she said. "Who else would it be?" "And don't give me a hard time about my cabinets. I can't help it." Her cabinets, the kitchen cabinets of an 83-year-old woman who lived alone, were crammed full of two giant jars of mayonnaise, three big family-sized bags of Doritos, four bottles of Thousand Island dressing, six cans of baked beans, countless tins of tuna fish. "I try to cut back," she said, "but I keep winning this stuff at bingo at the senior center." "Last Tuesday," she said, "I won four times. I had to stop playing. The other women were getting mad at me." Once she moved to Birmingham, I have to confess, her cabinets were not much emptier, and a lot of that was my fault. I inherited from her the DNA that makes it genetically impossible for me to pass up a two-for-one special at the grocery store. "Lots of good BOGOs this week," she would say as she scanned the supermarket ads in the newspaper. "BOGOs, buy one, get one free. Progresso soup, Dove ice cream bars, Ken salad dressing. Do we need salad dressing?" Did we need salad dressing as often as that stuff was on special? We were not going to ever have to buy salad dressing again for 25 years. "At least you share," she said to me once. "When I was still living in Reading, your Aunt Jean would take me to the grocery store. She'd take out her coupons and say, 'You buy one, I'll get one free.'" Sometimes we would go on a supermarket scavenger hunt, try to find specialty food items that are typical in Pennsylvania but impossible to find in Alabama. Things like the wide egg noodles that you need to make Pennsylvania Dutch style chicken pot pie, or the spicy red hot pepper relish that gives a zing to an authentic Philadelphia cheesesteak. We never were able to find those things, but it was fun to look. But then one time a friend told me that there was a store that advertised they were selling real Amish cheese. And so one Thursday afternoon, she and I set out for Miller's Cheese House in Vincent, Alabama, about 45 minutes away. We finally found it. It was there just off County Road 82, off County Road 84, off County Road 63, off County Road 61, off Highway 25, which intersects with Highway 280. What we found was a one-room concrete block building with worn wooden floors, two big coolers that had milk and cheese and butter from an Amish dairy farm in Ohio, and walls lined with narrow shelves that held jars of jams and jellies and preserves. We passed on those. Thanks to last week's BOGO, we had 132 unopened ounces of Welch's Great between us. But we did buy some cheese, a funny kind of Swiss cheese that didn't have any holes in it, and a sweet, creamy, pale yellow butter käse. The woman behind the cash register heard Mother's Pennsylvania accent, asked her where she was from. Turns out that woman was from Ohio, and she and Mother spent 20 minutes comparing recipes for shoe fly pie. And before we left, the woman disappeared into a little closet at the back of the room, came out with a cellophane bag of wide egg pot pie noodles. "You can't find these here," she said. "It'll make you think of home. Think of me when you use them. Come back and see me sometime." And she told us a shortcut for the way home. On the way back, my mother sang to me. And not really singing, but that's kind of the way it seemed, her voice high and soft in my ear. She was telling me about Antarctica, an article she had read about it in the Smithsonian Magazine. She told me about penguins and krill, their food source, and how the generator sounded churning away in the cold, silent, dark night, the way the Southern Cross constellation looked unobscured by any artificial light. She sang to me about penguins, this 80-some-year-old woman who was so interested in life, who all my life had modeled for me a sense of curiosity and wonder about the world. We got back to her house, put the cheese away, finished up a couple of pesky clues in that morning's crossword puzzle, sat on the patio, shared a BOGO Dove ice cream bar, and then, "Bye, sleep well, talk to you tomorrow, love you." A sweet, happy day. All the sweeter, all the happier, because neither of us had any idea it was the last one like that we would ever have. Because just a little while after that came the phone call at 5 in the morning, the trip to the emergency room, the diagnosis of multiple myeloma, the assignment of the hospice nurses and hospice aides, and she moved into my house, no assistant living if we could help it. And she and I began an 8-month journey. It lasted 8 months, and it ended with the purchase of 3 Waterford clocks. As we began that journey, a strange phenomenon started to take place. People, friends, neighbors, people I barely knew, started showing up with lasagna, cushions for Mother's wheelchair, DVDs of Marx Brothers comedies, paperback romance novels and detective stories, containers of homemade vegetable soup and banana nut muffins. People offered to stop at the grocery store on their way home to pick something up for us. People offered to make a late night run to the 24-hour pharmacy, offered to come and stay with Mother for a little while so I could get a break. It went on for 8 months. And somewhere in the middle of all that, 5-6 months into it, Mother was getting ready for bed, and as we usually did, we talked about the kind of day it had been. It had been the kind of day where Lucy had dropped off a quiche for us to share at lunch, and Anne had left a tin of lemon squares on the front porch. Rebecca had stayed with Mother for an hour or two so I could go do a story program. There had been 5 cards in the mail, "Thinking of you." And as I bent down to kiss Mother goodnight, she looked up at me and said, "Looks like I live in assisted living after all, don't I?" And I agreed that she did. And so did I. I had lived in assisted living all my life. And it had taken something like that for me to realize it. Well, in the time since all that happened, I've thought over and over again about that strange phenomenon of casseroles and cards and countless kindnesses showing up so generously in what is supposed to be a hard, cynical, selfish world. And when I try to explain that phenomenon to myself,
I think about Occam's razor and how the simplest explanation is probably the true one. And so I've decided that the simple, true explanation must be this, that at those moments in your life when you feel you are just about to drop, a little band of angels magically appears, hovering around you, holding you up, and staying with you until they see you safely back to solid ground.
Occam's Razor, a story told for you by Dolores Hydock about her and her mother, an apt beginning to an hour filled with mother's stories to celebrate Mother's Day. It's our pleasure to be with you, and coming up, you're going to hear stories from Linda Gorham and Doug Elliott, Pete Griffin, and Bill Harley. You're going to hear an entry in the Radio Family Journal as well about my mom. And of course, we always hope that the stories that we bring you here on the show spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people that you love. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on a special episode of The Appleseed in celebration of Mother's Day. Before the break, you heard a story called Occam's Razor, a terrific story told by the Alabama storyteller Dolores Hydock about the relationship that she shared with her mother. And there's a lot more coming up. You'll hear from Linda Gorham and Pete Griffin and North Carolina storyteller and naturalist Doug Elliott. You'll hear a song from Bill Harley. All in celebration of moms and the ones who love them. And we know that sharing memories can sometimes be the spark that ignites a story that you can share with the people that you love around the kitchen table or the living room. And to that end, here's a memory of mine, a memory of my mom, in an entry in the Radio Family Journal.
The Radio Family Journal with Sam Payne, a tiny little story for you and your family, right when you need it. On the Appleseed.
My mom was a fiddle player from California, and my earliest memory of her is the hazy image of looking up at her through the water of her folks' swimming pool, which I'd fallen into as a tiny kid. She jumped in and saved my life. She had a lot of patience with me. When I was two, we slept in the loft of a little 100-year-old brick house that we shared with another family while my folks finished school. Before bed one night, I put an unopened can of beans in the oven. No one noticed. Then at about 2 a.m, the house was rocked by an explosion. Everyone rocketed out of their beds and ran to the kitchen. The oven, which at one point had been roughly cubical, was now spherical. The oven door was hanging precariously, like you might imagine a blown-up oven door to be hanging in a Looney Tunes cartoon. Beans everywhere. My brother still owns one of those kitchen chairs, and it's still subtly decorated with bean stains. And the point is, I don't remember my mom freaking out. That's not to say I never saw her freak out. My mom made us some plastic plates once. You used to be able to buy a kit that included plate-shaped pieces of paper and magic markers, and you'd draw what you wanted with the magic markers on the plate-shaped pieces of paper, and then you'd send the pieces of paper back to the company, and they'd make plates out of your drawings. And we made some cool plates, but by far our favorite was the plate my mom made. It had a locomotive with a rabbit for an engineer, copied from a Richard Scarry illustration. Only in the Richard Scarry illustration, the flag on the locomotive had a picture of a carrot on it, and on my mom's plate, it had the letters S and J written on the locomotive's flag. S for Sam, and J for Joe, my brother. And we fought and we fought over that plate. And after about 2 million arguments between my brother and me over who got to eat from that plate, my mom cracked, smashed that railroad plate into 1,000 pieces on the kitchen floor. So there was stuff like that, too. and I remember that stuff about my mom. But more often, I remember how she had a premonition that her kids were in danger on the mountain behind our house, right about the time that my brother fell into the river above Horsetail Falls, and through her worry made a hot dinner for us and had it waiting for us when we got home, my safe but soggy brother in tow. What I remember about my mom is the time when I was 6 and was asked to wear a purple tuxedo and be the ring bearer at my Aunt Chris's wedding. And my mom pulled me into the basement room of the Baptist church and told me to walk tall down the aisle, like the swan in the Ugly Duckling story, she said, with your head held noble and high. She was quoting an old Danny Kaye record, the one with Tubby the Tuba on one side and Hans Christian Andersen stories on the other. It got me through the wedding and everything else from that day to this. What I remember about my mom is her face, the tears running down her cheeks, as she watched Nadia Comaneci flying on the uneven bars on TV when I was a kid. That's what I remember about my mom. And even today, if I were dying, swimming in a cold sweat, delirious and tortured by a weird jungle fever, I might call her name in my delirium. I don't know. She asked me over milk and cookies a couple of years ago if I felt like I'd had a good childhood. How could she not know? I looked at her in the face and said the only words I could think of. My childhood was blissful, Mom. You rock. Well, your mom probably knows, but just in case she doesn't, can you think of a better time to tell her than right now?
The Radio Family Journal of Sam Payne, a tiny little story for you and your family, right when you need it, on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for that entry in the Radio Family Journal. And of course, before that, a story called Occam's Razor by Dolores Hydock, a tender story, and just one of many that we're going to bring you today in celebration of Mother's Day. And up next, we've got a fun story from Linda Gorham. Now, this is a story called Help Me, Mama. No episode for Mother's Day would be complete without a nod to grandmothers. And in this story, Estelle has 4 children, whom she loves very much, but they're all noisy. So when Estelle needs a bit of help, she turns to her mother, the grandmother, for wisdom. This story is from a collection of Linda Gorham's tales called Common Sense and Uncommon Fun. It's kind of a spin on an old folk tale of which you may have heard one version or another, featuring a main character whose life is just a little bit too filled up with noise. Again, this story is called Help Me, Mama. You'll enjoy it. Here's Linda Gorham on the Appleseed.
This story is not from a long time ago. This story can take place anywhere, even in your house. Do you sometimes have a lot of noise in your house? Does it get crazy sometimes? I understand. Well, let me tell you about a mother named Estelle. She had 4 children. First, there was Abby. Abby loved to sing. Tra-la-la-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la-la. And then there was Betty. Betty loved to cry. Wah, wah, wah. And then there was Eddie. Eddie, he loved to laugh. And last but not least was Freddie, who loved to sing his ABCs. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Now, the problem was that they liked to do it all at the same time. Oh, now Estelle loved her children. Really, she did. They all had some wonderful qualities. Abby was a nice girl. She got good grades in school. She was polite, respectful. But when Abby started singing, oh boy. Tra-la-la-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la-la. Betty was a good helper around the house. Betty loved to help her mother vacuum and do dishes. She was very helpful. But when Betty started to cry, oh.
Wah, wah, wah.
Now, Eddie, Eddie always kept his room clean. I know it's amazing, but he did. He even put the top back on the toothpaste, and he always washed his hands before eating, even without being reminded. But when Eddie started laughing, look out. And the same was true of Freddie. He always helped his mother in the garden. He would help pull weeds and plant flowers. In the winter, he always volunteered to help shovel the snow. But when he started singing his ABCs, look out. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And sometimes they would do it all at the same time. Estelle did not like the noise. Estelle would say, Abby, Betty, Eddie, and Freddie, please, let's have just a little silence. But you know how kids are. Sometimes they just could not help themselves. After all, making noise is fun, right? Well, Estelle called her mother on the cell phone. She said, Mama, I'm going crazy. Well, thank goodness for cell phones, because Mama was never home. Mama was sitting in Starbucks with her girlfriend, sipping a cappuccino. Mama heard all of the children in the background laughing, singing, crying, and saying the ABCs. She said, Girl, your children are acting just like you and your brothers and sisters did when you were young. You kids drove me crazy, too. But I can help. Here is what you have to do. Turn on your radio to the opera channel and turn the volume up real high. Estelle turned on the radio and she heard, la 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 la, la 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 la. Then Abby, Betty, Eddie, and Freddie started making their noises. Estelle called her mother on the cell phone again, and she said, Mama, I'm going crazy. Well, thank goodness for cell phones, because Mama was never home. You see, right then, she was at her weekly private tennis lesson with Julio. Mama heard all the children laughing and singing and crying and saying the ABCs and the radio in the background. Mama said, Here is what you have to do. Buy a cuckoo clock and bring it home. Estelle went out and bought a cuckoo clock, and she hung it up on her wall. It wasn't long before the cuckoo clock started cuckooing. Cuckoo, 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 cuckoo. Then the opera came back on the radio. La 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 la. La 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 la. Then Abby, Betty, Eddie, and Freddie started making their noises. Oh, Estelle. She called her mother again on the cell phone. She said, Mama, I'm going crazy. Well, thank goodness for cell phones, because Mama was never home. Mama was in the middle of getting her monthly massage and pedicure, but she stopped and had a long talk with her daughter. Mama heard all of the children laughing, singing, crying, and saying the ABCs, plus she heard the radio and the cuckoo clock in the background. Mama said, Here is what you have to do. Turn on your television, turn it to the sports channel, and turn the volume up real high. Well, the sports announcers were announcing a football game, and they yelled, Touchdown! 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 Then the cuckoo clock started cuckooing, Touchdown! Cuckoo, touchdown! Cuckoo, touchdown! Cuckoo, touchdown! Cuckoo. Then the opera came back on the radio. Touchdown, 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 touchdown. Then Abby, Betty, Eddie, and Freddie started making their noises. Touchdown, touchdown, touchdown. Estelle called her mother again on the cell phone, and she said, Mama, I'm going crazy. Mama was home. What a surprise. Mama heard all the children laughing, singing, crying, and saying the ABCs. She heard the radio, the cuckoo clock, and the sports channel in the background. Mama said, Okay, dear, here is what you have to do. Go and get your grandfather and some of the other grandfathers from the neighborhood. Take them home and put them to sleep. Estelle, well, she gathered up all the grandfathers and she brought them home. They all went to sleep almost immediately because it was about 7 p.m. And all the grandfathers started snoring. The sports announcer was yelling, "Touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown!" The cuckoo clock started cuckooing, "Touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown!" The opera came back on the radio, "Touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown! Touchdown!" Then Abby, Betty, Eddie, and Freddie started making their noises. Estelle called her mother. She said, "Help!" Mama came over. Mama sent the snoring grandfathers home. Mama smashed the TV into bits with a hammer. Mama threw the cuckoo clock out of the window. Mama put the radio in the garbage can. And from then on, all Estelle could hear was Abby singing.
Tra-la-la-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la-la.
Betty crying.
Wah, wah, wah.
Eddie laughing. And Freddie saying the ABCs. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And you know what? Estelle realized that all those sounds were the sweet sounds of a full and lively house filled with children. And after all, silence in a family with children is no fun at all.
Linda Gorham with Help Me Mama, from a collection of stories called Common Sense and Uncommon Fun, a story that's kind of a spin on an old folk tale about a main character whose life is just a little bit too filled up with noise, a story that in all its versions seems in one way or another to be about appreciating the life that you have. And of course, in addition to being a spin on an old folk tale, Linda's story is about the kind of wisdom that we find when we go to our mothers or grandmothers for help. We're going to take a quick break and then back with a story from naturalist and storyteller Doug Elliott, a little North Carolina Mother's Day story coming up on the Appleseed. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to the Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's episode of The Appleseed in celebration of Mother's Day. Before the break, you heard a story called Help Me Mama by Linda Gorham, a spin on an old folk tale about a main character complaining of a noisy house and going, in this case, to Grandma for counsel and help. You know, if it makes you think of counsel and help that you've received from your mother or your grandmother, share that counsel or help or the story of it with the people that you love around the kitchen table or the living room. Coming up next, we've got a story from North Carolina naturalist and storyteller Doug Elliott. Now, Doug spends a lot of time telling stories about wisdom learned in observation of the natural world. But this story, Roosevelt and Ira Lee, is just a fun story about preparing for Mother's Day. Doug Elliott from a collection called Bullfrogs on Your Mind, Stories, Songs, and Adventures from the Swamps to the Hen House, with a story called Roosevelt and Ira Lee, here on the Appleseed.
There's these two young fellas, Roosevelt and Ira Lee. They down by the river in the swamps, sitting there on a log. It's Saturday night, and they're sitting there pondering on what they're gonna do for the night. Thing is, this was no ordinary Saturday night. This was the night before Mother's Day. And those two young dudes, they were just sitting there. Not only were they pondering on what they were gonna do to entertain themselves that night, they were also trying to figure what they could do for their mamas. I mean, these boys love their mamas. But there was no way they could buy any Mother's Day presents. They lived way out in the country. They didn't have any way to get to town. And even if they did, they still didn't have a thin dime between them to buy anything with. So they were just sitting there pondering. Well, finally, they just figured out that since this was Saturday night, and Saturday night didn't come but just every now and then, they'd just find something fun to get into right then. And they could ponder about tomorrow when they came to it.
river was dark and muddy, and the moon was on the rise. All of the creatures in the swampland had woke up to feed for the night. Roosevelt and Ira Lee were sitting there on a log. Ira Lee turned to Roosevelt, said, I sure would like to have a mess of bullfrogs. He said, yeah, 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 it sure would taste fine. Slipped on their rubber boots and walked down to the water's edge. Right away they knew the night would be a bummer, cause I really stepped on the water, musking head, and he said, wah, 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 Lord, somebody help me. Turned to Roosevelt when he quit all the screaming and kicking. Said, why don't we forget about them bullfrog legs and go out and get us some chicken? He said, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, it sure would taste fine. I love my chicken. And you know what? Mama loves chicken too. So is my mama, says Ira Lee. And what she really loves is chicken pie. Hey, you know what we could do? We could sneak back to my house. Everyone's asleep by now. And there's a couple of those young roosters. They got out of the coop and they've been roosting in the trees. Flew the coop, did they? Yeah, but they're still hanging around. They're sleeping up in the trees right above the chicken house. Daddy can't catch them. He said he's gonna put him in the stew pot when he does. Well, we'll sneak over there tonight, and we'll catch him. We won't make a sound. We'll take him to the outdoor kitchen, and we'll cook them birds. We'll invite your mama over, and your daddy over, and we'll cook everybody the finest Mama's Day dinner they ever had. Won't they be surprised?
Roosevelt and Ira Lee, a story from naturalist and storyteller and musician Doug Elliott. You know, I hear that story and I think of what it feels like to sit and try to think of what you're going to do for your mom for Mother's Day. I remember when I was a little kid making a bookshelf for my mom out in the shed with my brother. We brought that bookshelf into the house, and as homely as it was, my mom kept it for years and years and years until my brother and I were grown-up people. It's always a pleasure to bring you a Doug Elliott story, and up next you're going to hear a story from Pete Griffin. This is called You'll Never Take Me Alive, in which Pete's mom gets a letter from the government faulting her for a crime she never committed. Will she just roll over and take the blame? Well, that's the story. Here's Pete Griffin with You'll Never Take Me Alive on the Appleseed.
I grew up in Cedarville, a small town in Upper Michigan. You might recall from your geography classes that Michigan is toward the top of the 48 contiguous states. You remember, the one that's shaped like a mitten. But there are two parts to the state. The mitten part is the lower peninsula. The upper peninsula, the UP, is the part that arches over top of the mitten. There are some differences between the two parts of the state. The UP is relatively undeveloped with lots of forests and swamps with few roads, while the Lower Peninsula is Detroit, Grand Rapids, and Lansing and all of their suburbs. There are more factories and roads than you can count. People in the Lower Peninsula looked at those of us in the Upper Peninsula as somewhat backward and unsophisticated. My parents were hard-working folks. Dad built houses in the summer. In the winter, he built cabinets and furniture in his garage. He fixed cars and lawnmowers, anything with an engine. Mom had worked for years at the two grocery stores in town. She'd worked as a teller at our local bank and went on to edit our weekly newspaper for a number of years. They had raised my sister and me to respect those in authority, to respect teachers, and to respect our elders. Now, by the time I graduated high school, I pretty much knew everything. I went on to college to fill in a few knowledge gaps. For college, I had to buy a car, but we put it in my mother's name because, despite the fact that I knew everything, insurance companies didn't put much stock in 19-year-olds and their driving abilities. Putting ownership in Mom's name gave us a break on insurance rates. Well, one Friday afternoon that fall, I came home from school for the weekend and found my mother sitting at the kitchen table, tapping an envelope into the palm of her hand like a police baton. The envelope had a big seal on it like it might be important. "Have you ever been to Lansing?" she asked. Puzzled, I answered, "No, I've never been to Lansing. I never drive in big cities." "You never loaned your car to someone who drove it to Lansing?" "Absolutely not," I said. "Nobody drives my car but me." "Well, how do you explain this?" she said, handing me the envelope. I unfolded the letter and read it. "Dear Mrs. Griffin, in August of this year, your car was cited for a parking violation in the city of Lansing. You failed to take advantage of the opportunity to pay your fine by mail within the time limit described in your citation. As such, we have set a date in December to bring your case before a judge. Your appearance in court is mandatory. Should you fail to appear, a bench warrant will be issued for your arrest. Your attention to this matter would be greatly appreciated. Sincerely, Roger Harris, Assistant Attorney, City of Lansing." Oh, no, this was serious. "Geez, Mom, I've never been to Lansing. My car has never been to Lansing. I don't know how this happened." Mom gave me a look. You know the one. The lie detector look. The look that all mothers have. From experience, that look was about 99% effective in detecting lies. Well, I passed her test. She believed me. The next day, she handed me a letter she wrote. "Dear Mr. Harris, just where do you get off frightening little old ladies from the Upper Peninsula half to death with threats of arrest for parking violations? For your information, I have never been to Lansing. My car has never been to Lansing, and my son who drives my car has never been to Lansing. I believe a mistake has been made. I suggest that you double-check your records before pursuing this further. Your attention to this matter would be greatly appreciated. Sincerely, Eldith Griffin, Mother, Town of Cedarville." Holy smokes, I said, handing the letter back to her. Isn't this just asking for more trouble? "Maybe," she said, "but I want them to know I'm serious." She looked at her letter again, frowning. "It's still missing something," she said. Picking up her pen, she wrote across the bottom of the page, "P.S. You'll never take me alive." She sealed the letter, and off it went. About 3 weeks later, she received another official-looking letter from the city of Lansing. "Dear Mrs. Griffin, we don't like frightening little old ladies from the UP half to death. For the most part, it's far too cold and way too dark up there for our comfort. At your suggestion, we did review our records regarding this citation, and lo and behold, a mistake had been made. While the license plate number was correct, we found that the vehicle in question was registered in the state of New Mexico, rather than the state of Michigan, please accept my deepest apologies for causing you any distress in this matter. Sincerely, Roger Harris, Assistant Attorney, City of Lansing. P.S. If it had actually come to executing a warrant for your arrest, I would like to think we could have avoided bloodshed. You see, the City of Lansing hasn't hanged a parking violator since 1957. Well, Mom and Dad are both gone now, but they left my sister and me with a wonderful inheritance. Not the kind of inheritance that would allow us to go out and buy a new truck or a new boat, but the kind of inheritance that will last us the rest of our lives. Values of respect for people in authority, respect for teachers, respect for our elders, and the idea that maybe, just maybe, a little humor, even when things are pretty serious, can help you out of a pinch. Thanks, Mom.
Pete Griffin with a story about his mom called You'll Never Take Me Alive. That's from a collection of stories called The Skunk Whisperer. And up next, a little thing from Bill Harley called 50 Ways to Fool Your Mother. About 50 different ways to get out of having to go to school. Isn't that the classic mother-child conflict? We've all been there, days when we simply don't want to go to school, but mothers are rarely fooled. So take notes from Bill Harley on the Appleseed.
Early in the morning when you open up your eyes, you can smell the coffee perking and the egg your mother fries. Lying in your bed, you start to feel blue when you think of all the things that you really want to do. You want to play baseball, you want to ride your bike, you want to read a comic book, you want to take a hike. No, you don't. There's something else to do. Dress yourself and have your breakfast. You got to go to school. If just this once, you didn't have to go. But if you ask, they'll just say,
no!
If you only think a moment, there's something you can do. There must be 50 ways to fool your mother.
50 ways to fool your mother!
Well, it's really rather simple if you only stop and think. You could tell her you got sick last night, threw up in the sink. Say you got the measles, say you got the mumps. Tell her that you're too depressed, wait on in the dumps. Tell her you're not you, there's a Martian in your place. You're really on a rocket ship somewhere in outer space. You got to use your head, I'm sure you'll find a way. There must be 50 ways to fool your mother.
50 ways to fool your mother!
You can tell her that your teacher said you done so well. You don't have to go to school today, you could rest a spell. Tell her that a tidal wave is coming to your town. If you try to get to school, you just might drown. Say a herd of elephants is running through the streets. Your shoes have shrunk, they won't fit on your feet. Say your school was zapped into hyperspace. There must be 50 ways to fool your mother.
50 ways to fool your mother!
You're turtle sick, you gotta stay at home. You're waiting for the president to call you on the phone. Say you're sore and icky, there's a pounding in your head. Your legs won't move, you can't get out of bed. Tell her that you won't get up, you know it's just a dream. You know your real mother would never act so mean. Put some powder on your face until it's really white.
Heat up the thermometer over the light.
Get some iodine and put some spots upon your face. There must be 50 ways to fool your mother.
50 ways to fool your mother! Oh yeah!
So your mother finally buys it. She says, okay, but if you're so sick, you can't go out to play. You gotta stay at home. You got to get some rest. I could help you with your homework. You could study for your test. Maybe by tomorrow you'll feel okay. I'm really very sorry that you're sick on Saturday. Saturday! I thought it was Friday! Your mother smiles sweetly as she gets up to leave. You should have known the mother's got something up their sleeve. There must be some way out of this. Something you can do. Are there 50 more ways to fool your mother?
50 ways to fool your mother!
I wanna know the
50 ways to fool your mother!
You gotta show the
50 ways to fool your mother!
Give it up! Hey, Mom! Is it nice outside? I'm feeling a lot better now. Really.
50 Ways to Fool Your Mother, a classic from Bill Harley, the storyteller and songwriter here on The Appleseed. We're going to wrap up our hour together with one more little piece, an observation made by me and my musician friends of mothers and daughters at a wedding. As gigging musicians, my friends and I play a lot of weddings. It's our bread and butter, actually. Steadier work for musicians than just about any other kind of show. We've seen and done some interesting stuff down in the wedding trenches. One time we played for a big wedding at the Art Museum downtown, held midway through the run of an exhibit of rare antique hats. As the evening progressed, people began to loosen up and dance. We noticed these terrific hats cropping up on the heads of some members of the tuxedoed wedding party. Man, cool hats, we thought. I wonder where in town they found those. And then it occurred to us to look around the museum exhibit. With a shock of horror, noticed an increasing number of empty hat display stands. On another evening, we played for a wedding party full of old folks and young folks all hanging around to hear the music. One young man asked elderly Aunt So-and-so to dance, and they cut a rug right there in front of us. That is, until the young man got carried away and deeply dipped his aged aunt and her wig fell off. The inadvertent trashing of museum exhibits and the doffing of hair pieces will become the legendary family gathering stories of families all over the state. And we're there to see many of them. We seldom say much about them, just keep playing music through thick and thin. We played a wedding not too long ago, in which they asked me to be what amounted to the sound guy during their ring ceremony. The ceremony was performed right there on the dance floor, right in front of the band setup. The family and friends of the bride and groom formed a circle around them, and the bride and groom exchanged rings and vows. They were both laughing and crying tears of joy at the same time. And I found myself watching the circle of smiling onlookers. There, next to the bride and groom, was the bride's sister and her husband. A few years older than the newlyweds, she with a baby girl on her hip, and he holding the hand of a young boy. Next to them were the bride's parents. Both of them were battle-weary from a long day, but they were holding hands, the patriarch and matriarch of this whole clan. Mom was smiling, and Dad was somber and misty-eyed. Down the line was another sister of the bride's, freshly engaged to the young man standing next to her, engaged, as we found out, only the day before. Their youthful faces were full of the bright anticipation of future days. And there were others in the circle, too, but I kept watching the family. And I don't know how to explain this exactly, except to say that they seemed for a moment to be one person. The younger sister and the bride and the older sister and the mother. One person that I was allowed to see at different points on the path. Freshly engaged, wearing the ring, holding the child, and looking back at her adult children. And at each place, the person believes that that place is all there is. Each of them feeling so much, living such a rich moment, that that moment seems like the only moment. Right now, in this moment, I'm the father of a growing family. I have four sons in this moment. There is a guitar in this moment, and a mortgage. There's church work to be done. And this moment often seems like the only moment. And I guess there's something to be said for that. But in some other moment, I was in high school. I was stronger and faster in that moment, and more naive. There will sometime be a moment where I lift a baby grandchild in my arms. There is quite a different me
in each of those places on the path. And if I were to get all those guys together, I wonder what we'd talk about. I wonder what we could tell each other. What dangers we could warn each other of. What beauties we could call each other's attention to. And maybe, most importantly, what responsibilities we have to one another. One thing's for sure. I wouldn't mind wearing in any moment the look passed around the circle by the family of the bride that evening. The look that melted away eventually into dancing, accompanied by the music of an enthusiastic and ever more pensive band. Such a pleasure to have been with you today for stories and songs from Bill Harley, Pete Griffin, Doug Elliott, and Linda Gorham from Dolores Hydock. Always a pleasure to fill an hour with stories for you, especially in celebration of Mother's Day today. This hour was written by Alyssa Mingorance. Our audio engineer is Carly Robison. Our producer, Jeff Simpson. I'm Sam Payne. Can't wait to be with you again on The Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for an hour of stories, music, and conversation made for you and your family and brought to you by The Appleseed. The show is a production of BYU Radio. We'll see you next time.